You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, August 20th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, journalist Anna Clark on the poisoned city, Flint's water, and the American urban tragedy. Also on the program today, Michael Cohen, looking at 20 million new reasons why he might want to start talking about Donald Trump to federal authorities. Meanwhile, Don McGahn has been talking to federal authorities, the Mueller investigation, but probably not about the stuff that he's in trouble for. Meanwhile, confirmation that the bomb that killed 40 children in Yemen was supplied directly by the U.S. We've got the name of the companies that make these wonderful killing machines. New York Times endorses Zephyr Teachout for New York Attorney AG position, possibly one of the most important, if not the most important, state positions in the country, or could be. It's Monday. One more opportunity to remind you that ICE is a terror organization. The ACLU looks to sue Georgia over its disenfranchisement plan. And the heartwarming story of a Trumpista that became a Black Lives Matter activist. Lastly, fact checkers flattened by the truth of Medicare for All. All this and more, ladies and gentlemen, on today's program. Yes, it is Monday, getting closer to the end of summer. we're a week away from our big vacation. Everybody else has been on vacation. Everyone else in this office has been on vacation, all right, I should just say. But this is my big vacation. This is when I let it all hang out, folks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Watch out.
Pump up the volume.
Exactly. Exactly. With the kids for 7 days straight.
Did you say pump up the volume?
Volume.
Yeah. The volume.
Just checking.
Oh, really?
You're oh, hey, I just want to do an update on what we talked about on Friday. So we had on Friday, we had Ronald Reagan on. To talk about a client of his who was on bond, being held subject to bond. The guy's name was Umberto. He was brought to the country when he was just 3 years old. 2014, Umberto became a father. He is being detained in the Northwest Detention Center, an immigration judge set bond at $15,000. Umberto's mom did not have this money. They really had no idea what they were going to do. Ronald Reagan set up a GoFundMe. He came on Friday. I think at that point, maybe they had raised a grand or two. As of now, they are $1,300 past the goal of $15,000. Obviously, not just a function of you listeners, but a big part of that is from the listeners. On top of which, because of the system with GoFundMe, Umberto would not be released, I think, until later this week. At the end of the week, maybe the end of the month. another listener apparently has stepped up and said that he or she would front the money and get paid back via the GoFundMe. So incredibly generous. The generosity that you've all shown is amazing. I imagine some of that extra cash is going to go into the attempt to build this rolling bond fund so that when folks find themselves in the position that Umberto is in, they will rely on the bond fund and it will be replenished slowly. So this is, I think, will hopefully end up being a long-term project. But you should all feel very proud of this community. I certainly do. And so thank you for your generosity. You've, you know, materially impacted the life of not just Umberto, but his children or his child and his parents. So good for you. Meanwhile, let's turn to this story. This is also a heartwarming story of a slightly different flavor. This is coming out of Lakeland, Florida. This is a Florida airport. I'm not sure which one. Apparently, a customer, Jeffrey Epstein, he's a doctor in Lakeland, Florida, was unhappy with the service that he was getting from the airline. We've all been there. It's very, very frustrating. Well, Jeffrey Epstein, according to him after the fact, wanted to make a point. So he started to increase his volume, and at one point police officers came, and he was rather challenging with them, not physically, but so as you can see, he's dressed in a business suit. And here he is being apprehended by the police in the Lakeland, Florida airport. Listen to what the revelation he has in the course of him struggling with the police.
I'm not. Stop. Do not hurt me. Do not hurt me. You understand? Do not be rough with me. Look at them. Look at them. They're going to beat me up. Don't beat me up, you mother. Don't beat me up. Look at them. Oh, my God. I can't believe they're doing this. Oh, my God. Hey. Hey. Look what they're doing. Oh, get to the other side. I'm not listening. I swear to be rough with me. Treat me like a black person!
You're gonna get sprayed! You're gonna get sprayed! Release your hands, put it behind your back. You understand me?
There you go. He realizes in the course of resisting arrest that he's being treated like a black person. He uses another adjective to make that point, but it's beeped out. He ultimately was sprayed to get him to put his arms behind his back. According to an affidavit acquired by a news station, WESH, he told police that he, quote, created a very big disturbance and I did it on purpose. If you're going to do this to a white doctor who's 59 years old for doing nothing, then why would black people trust you?
So basically every Trump in line with all conservative experiences and conversions to supporting things like civil rights, every single Trump supporter needs to be assaulted by the police in this country.
I'm a conservative Republican. I'm a Trump guy. But until the police fix this problem, I don't blame black people for being upset when they get arrested.
Yeah, note to Florida man, do not take your flocka the same day that you fly. It's never going to end well.
Sam, as you know, I have a Blue Lives Matter tat on my abdomen. No one supports the men in blue more than me, and perhaps there should be a style guide, Samantha, so people can understand this character at some point. Mm. But that being said, we are men, not animals. And when you see Dr. Epstein treated in this manner, he's not a thug. He's not a spear chucker. He's not someone who hates this country. He's a Jewish doctor. And if it could happen to him, well, it certainly could happen to your goddamn Rachel face.
Right. Well,
so
that's,
think
that's
about
not really
it and get serious.
He goes on
those
to say,
those boys must have had a very bad day dealing with Dominicans or something.
He goes on to say, I was not in danger. I was being loud because I wanted everyone else to see, Epstein told WESH. After being released from jail, big companies have to take care of their customers. And when they call the cops in, they got to de-escalate, not escalate. He seems to be all over the place.
He's all over the
place. He's a little bit of like a consumer advocate, a little bit of a Black Lives Matter supporter.
All all wrapped in one huge amount Trump of asshole show.
Yes. I had my white privilege suspended for a very brief moment. I am supposed to be able to yell at the people in the airport. I am a doctor.
He really lost me in the last 5 seconds, Dad.
Folks, this actually, I turned somebody on to this liquid IV just this weekend. They have, I know somebody who gets like severely dehydrated. That's and they get a headache and like the neck. Summer's in full swing. We're all feeling the heat. Thankfully, Liquid IV helps prevent dehydration, especially when spending more time outside the beach, hiking, and having fun. Liquid IV is not your average electrolyte drink, Mitch. Mix with non-GMO, clean ingredients. It's a healthy alternative to sports drink, and it can provide the same hydration as drinking 2 to 3 bottles of water. It even contains 5 essential vitamins, including more vitamin C than an orange and as much potassium as a banana. They have convenient TSA-friendly powder packs that help prevent jet lag and altitude sickness for all your summer travels. That is the big thing. Travel, and then heavy drinking, I think it seems to be the problem, my friend. Look, I love Liquid IV. I know you will, too. Still have... Well, now we're down to 2 packets there.
We use those around here.
I know that. Do not take any of those. Those are my packets. Stop.
Stop it.
Right now, my listeners, get off of me! My listeners get 20% off at liquid-iv.com when you use my code MAJORITY at checkout. That's 20% off anything you order at Liquid IV's website. Go to liquid-iv.com. Enter my promo code MAJORITY. Get your savings. Start getting better hydration. That's liquid-iv.com. Promo code MAJORITY. Don't wait. Get hydrated today. Folks, I did Haze Friday night with Ali Velshi. It's the first time.
Hi, Ali.
He was a nice guy. He's perfectly nice guy.
He seems like a nice guy.
He did 15 shows last week because he was filling in for his. Wow. Yeah, it's a lot of shows. Meanwhile, that's my long way of saying I had to shave. And as always, I shaved with my Harry's. Harry's founders knew that a great shave comes down to great blades made with sharp, durable steel that lasts. That's why they make some of the highest quality blades in the world, priced much lower than the leading brand. And they'll even give you a full refund if you don't love your shave. That's nuts. All you got to do is let them know within 30 days. Harry stands behind the quality of their blades, so they created a $13 value trial set that comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. They got the weighted ergonomic handle. That's my favorite. They got the 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip. I feel like I could get away with 4 blades, but the lubricating strip and the trimmer blade, those are key for me. Rich lathering shave gel, the travel blade cover, which of course is important unless you want your hands all cut up. Claim yours by going to harrys.com/majority report. And now listeners can redeem their trial set at harrys.com/majority report. You got to go to harrys.com/majority report to redeem your offer. Let them know I sent you to support the show. And these guys have stuck with us through thick and thin, Harry's. They really have. Lastly,
true story.
As I look out across the, and I did some work in the studio this weekend.
Very proud of yourself. I am.
Handyman this is pretty sweet setup here.
Every time I see you do something new, I always think of that guy on Chappelle's show with where he goes, "Pray to God that doesn't fall."
Yeah, I
pray to God that don't fall.
I do have that feeling. It was a little dicey. It was not easy putting that up by myself. There was a lot of trial and error, I can assure you. But as I look out on this newly renovated set, I actually see a hire from ZipRecruiter. Hiring used to be hard. You have multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, confusing review process. Today, hiring can be easy. You only have to go to one place to get it done, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's where Brendan Finn showed up. That's where we found him. He was lost in the wilderness. No idea what to do with his life. Young kid, took him off the streets.
He's like, you guys, you don't like fish, right? And we're like, no. And he's like, okay, I will work here, sir.
I don't know what that means. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience to apply. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. True. Folks, small business. This we don't have a smaller business. You can't have a smaller business in this one. But mid-size, big business, super easy. If you're an HR person, this is an awesome, I would think this would be an awesome sort of like back end for you. Super easy to use. I found great, great, great candidates. It's no wonder ZipRecruiter has the highest rated hiring site in America. And now my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter.com/majority, folks. It's the smartest way to hire. And I've said this before, the best time to start looking for people is when you do not need them. So even if you're not hiring anybody right now, go check it out. Get a sense of what you do need and what's out there. Believe me, it'll save yourself so much heartbreak and difficulty when that person comes up and tells you like, oh, hey, I'm leaving. I got 2 weeks. Yep. All right, folks, going to take a quick break and head to we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Anna Clark, a journalist, about the poison city, Flint's water, and the American urban tragedy. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program a Detroit-based author and journalist, Anna Clark, on her latest, The Poison City, Flint's Water, and the American Urban Tragedy. Welcome to the program, Anna.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very glad to be here.
Okay, let's start before, and obviously, and I think people, hopefully this audience has some, at very least, some sort of broad stroke awareness of this entire episode, which in some respects is not nearly over, and neither for Flint or other urban cities in the country. And when we talk about Flint, we talk about 12 people who are killed. Many more we don't know the implications of. And right now there are 15 people who have been indicted. But let's, before we get to any of that, let's go to prior to this specific crisis. Let's talk a little bit about Flint, which in 1960 had doubled the population and was a booming city.
It was. It had about 200,000 people. It had been growing very fast, and the leaders of the city at the time thought the city was only going to continue to grow. They were, of course, an industrial hub for General Motors. There were a number of other manufacturing companies there. There was a thriving cultural scene. There was a sort of a nationally renowned community schools movement. And Flint was also one of the most segregated cities in the country. It was it had two African-American neighborhoods, and those were those lines were rigidly held. It was literally the most segregated city in the North and the third most segregated city nationwide. So in the 60s, was, you know, with folks pouring into the city for all these jobs, the Great Migration, you know, made Flint a real destination. There was also a lot of growing tension about unequal opportunity in Flint.
What made Flint? I mean, my sense is, having had having spent a decent amount of time in Michigan over the past decade or so, that when we talk about like the urban and rural suburban divide in Michigan, we're talking about race. And many of the stories about Michigan, I mean, obviously in this country too, race plays a big factor. But what, why? I mean, what were the forces that kept Flint so segregated?
Well, the it was racism. It was, I mean, there was the leaders of the community, both the political leaders and General Motors leaders, the folks at influential foundations, including the C.S. Mott Foundation. These were often the same people, and they had, you know, no faith at all that a community could thrive if it were integrated. You know, they just didn't believe it was possible. And so you got these, like, you know, almost absurd scenarios where, you know, maybe an African-American family, you know, is able to, like, work with a white ally, for example, and move into a white neighborhood. And then you would immediately see the school district sort of, you know, change its boundaries to keep the children of that family from going to the so-called white school. There's a historic field house in Flint called Burston Field House, a real neighborhood hub for the youth in the area. They had a very popular swimming pool that white children were welcome to 6 days a week, while black children were relegated to a sprinkler across the street. That one day that African-American children could use the pool, after they left, the field house would drain it and refill it with new water before the white children came back the next day. You had city leaders performing in blackface for laughs at, like, charity events, you know? And you had some, you know, like, really familiar forms of intimidation, too, that we've seen, you know, all over the country. And, you know, like, I think, you know, Flint's kind of interesting because it, its African-American population, it had its big surge a little bit later than a lot of other communities in the North. A lot of, you know, the migration, like, Detroit kind of acted as a sponge, you know, that, like, made the surge for Flint's African-American community come a little bit later than others. But when it did come, it came fast. And the population, you know, in the, I think about in the 1960s, African-American population in Flint had, like, quintupled in just, you know, a couple of decades. And they were still only limited to those two neighborhoods. So they were just bursting at the seams. And, you know, and people are, of course, taking advantage of that, you know, with, you know, outrageously priced, you know, apartments that weren't up to code, for example. Flint, interestingly, it had one of the first African-American mayors. The mayor position was a little bit different at the time. It was more like a city council president. It was appointed. Right. But even the mayor himself was only allowed to, like, purchase a home in one of these two neighborhoods. He eventually becomes a fair housing advocate through the movement that was rising in that city in the 1960s.
So, okay. So that's where Flint was in the 60s. And then walk us through. We start to see it's impacted by sort of, I guess, three or four different forces that create a downward spiral in terms of resources and in terms of, like, the health of the city.
Yeah. There's a number of different things going on, and of course, you know, all interrelated with each other. For example, so in Flint, like in a lot of other communities, once fair housing laws were passed, once school desegregation laws were passed, people started leaving. Flint marked its first ever downturn in population in 1970, which is, you know, less than 2 years after the National Fair Housing Act and after Flint passed an ordinance itself for fair housing, finally. And immediately, you know, white people generally were moving out to the suburbs. So that's another force, is just the rise of these suburbs, these communities on the outskirts of core cities that were being subsidized and incentivized by a number of state and federal policies. You know, highways made it easier to commute, for example. People were able to sort of recreate a sort of de facto segregation. And they were also supported by a number of lending policies and insurance policies that set those suburban communities up to succeed. There was also the industrial factories were beginning to like disperse, right? And that's for a number of global reasons that was happening too, but also some of that was happening because of national policies. There was, like, for example, during the Truman administration, there was a presidential policy that was wanted to that felt like it was a vulnerability to have like to concentrate our industries, and so there was like incentivized programs to disperse them to suburbs and sometimes very far afield. So that also led to a lot of like industrial vacancy in Flint, as well as residential vacancy. And then you're also just seeing the sort of legacy of this like infrastructure inequality that we built into a city like Flint, you know, just play out as you would expect when there's no one intervening to stop it, you know, and it leads us to the point that, you know, we're seeing people have unequal access to drinking water.
Right. And so, okay. So by the time we get up to like the aughts, right, and we have the financial crisis, just tell us a little bit about the idea of revenue sharing and the implications for Flint in the way that Michigan handled their revenue sharing, particularly with a place like Flint.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think that's one of the most influential yet under-chronicled aspects of the Flint water crisis is revenue sharing. So this is it's basically how local governments are funded. Like, states collect money through like sales taxes and then disperses that money to local governments. It's not like sort of a charitable act by the state. It's often like by statute, you know, or by a state constitution, you know, and it distributes this money to local governments that they are then able to use for a number of public services. In Michigan, beginning in about 2002, the state started just keeping the revenue sharing to fill holes in its own budget. Michigan was going through a number of financial challenges, and it felt like it needed this money. And so, and even when the state began to have a budget surplus again, it has continued this practice of withholding revenue sharing from its communities. This is deeply unpopular among local government leaders, and has led many communities to, have to make cuts that they wouldn't otherwise want to make. But in communities that were already in a kind of shaky place like Flint, it has been absolutely devastating. So Flint, for example, had it received the same amount of revenue sharing that it would have otherwise received had the state not, you know, made such severe cuts, it would have had an additional $55 million between 2002 and 2016 to invest in its own public services. It needed that money. The lack of that money is probably part of what accounted for the state deciding that Flint was in a such a severe financial emergency that it needed one of its own appointed emergency managers to take control. I think it's interesting to put Michigan's revenue sharing story in national context too. Even throughout the national recession, only five states like reduced the amount of revenue sharing it provided to local governments. You know, with the loss of property taxes, for example, right. during the housing crisis, like they really, you know, like most actually increased it. but five states, including Michigan, made cuts, and Michigan was by far the most. The second most was Kansas, with about 14%. It cut revenue sharing about 14%. Michigan cut it like 50-some%.
And we should note, Kansas, of course, as of 2012, started deep tax cuts. Ostensibly because Arthur Laffer is a magician, and there was going to be a lot more revenue after you made all those tax cuts, and so nothing happened there. And I would also guess, I mean, and just to be clear, so that people understand this, property taxes are usually earmarked to local schools and whatnot, and to the extent that there has to be makeups from there, it puts even more stress on the state to make up that difference. I would bet, and I don't know, but I would bet that in the years preceding this, there were tax cuts for wealthy people in Michigan, would be my guess. And in some ways, this is how it's paid for. The state doesn't have the money when it's crunch time because the tax cuts, and they just basically pull it from the municipalities. And then all of a sudden, it becomes the political problem and real life problem of the municipalities, and the elected state representatives get away with their tax cut.
Yeah, there's this like really weird compartmentalization almost. You know, like on one hand, you know, you have the state government sort of suggesting that, you know, the fiscal problems in these local communities is just a matter of local leadership. You know. Like, well, that's your own fault for not being able to balance the budget, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, it's like, you know, enacting these policies that are literally, you know, and strategically disinvesting in them, you know, and just sort of like feigning ignorance about what the real life consequences are, especially for communities like Flint, like Detroit, where I live, like a number of communities across the state that are more vulnerable, that have, you know, a profound amount of vacancy, that aren't able to collect a lot from property taxes. Communities in Michigan are very, very limited in how they're able to raise revenue of any kind. With these cuts to revenue sharing statewide, you're seeing a lot of other communities, put income taxes on the ballot. You know, they're trying to, you know, fill holes that the state seems determined not to restore.
And again, it seems like to me that it's, you know, it's just, you know, this is maybe painting with just a slightly too broad a brush, but it seems like, you know, sort of a racial calculation and, you know, a political racial calculation where Governor Snyder says, like, I'm really not the governor of the cities in this state, more or less. I'm the governor of the suburbs and the rural communities, and they're not. So we can starve the cities and pay no political price. I mean, and then of course it gets worse as we go on. So let's we get to the point where in I guess it's 2011. Darnell Early is appointed emergency manager. Tell us about what emergency manager. I mean, hopefully people have a small sense of this, but I think Flint used a weak city council, a strong city manager system, which is at least accountable to the city council. The emergency manager is not. Tell us about that program.
Sure. Okay. So emergency management is a system that started, its roots in Michigan came in the late 80s, and it was initially a law designed to, you know, kind of provide state oversight and resources to one particular community, Hamtramck. And it was since expanded to apply to other cities and school districts that were struggling. But it was rarely used, and initially these emergency financial managers, as they were called at the time, only had authority over budgets. And after the election of Governor Snyder, and with the, you know, Republicans controlling all levels of our government, they passed a more expanded version of this law that set a lower bar for what would qualify a community for this kind of state intervention. And it gave these emergency managers really a really wide authority. So not only would the state-appointed administrator have the full authority of a city council and mayor, they would also have the full authority of a school board or a superintendent, if it was a school. And but they could also make or break contracts unilaterally. They could sell resources. The one thing they can't do is miss a payment to a bond payment to creditors, which I think is interesting. And they also can stay.
I don't want to skip over that for a second. I don't want to skip over that because that's really important, because it's basically saying like we're functionally in what looks like a chapter, 11 situation, or, a bankruptcy. Maybe there's a specific number for it in terms of, and we're getting protection essentially from all our creditors. We don't owe anybody anything we promised except for the wealthy people who have loaned us the money.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, that's the thing. Like, if a city stopped missing these payments, then suddenly it's going to start affecting the, like, credit ratings of other communities and of the state in general, And to protect them from the negative consequences of that, they bar these disinvested communities that are very broke from missing a single one of those payments, while providing no similar level of protection for, like, say, the public services of required to support the well-being of residents within that community. This upset people. This was controversial enough that it went up for a statewide referendum in 2012, and Michigan voters voted it down. They're like, this is too much. It's too far, going too far. And about a month later, the lame duck legislature passed a nearly identical version of the law with some tweaks to it. And one of the most significant tweaks was that it added appropriations to the bill, which made it immune from another referendum. They really hurried this along, probably because they knew that emergency management for Detroit was imminent, and also our bankruptcy.
What was the response in Michigan to this? I mean, because this is so blatantly anti-democratic. First of all, you have a piece of anti-democratic legislation, right, that gets rejected by the voters. And then the same people pushing this anti-democratic legislation reject the rejection by the voters. I mean, there's...
They did.
what was the reaction in Michigan? Were people just not... I mean, at one point you would think people would start getting outraged by this, but.
I think people were, but also it was reported on the time. It was clear it was happening at the time, but then suddenly the train just kept on moving. Within a couple months, here's the Detroit emergency manager, and then a couple months after that, the bankruptcy set. It's like suddenly everything, it wasn't lost on folks. There have been a number of lawsuits challenging this emergency manager law, not least for its racially disparate impact, which has voting rights implications.
Right. And that's the point, right? I mean, ultimately, there wasn't enough white people who were impacted by this who cared to actually punish their politicians in terms of their vote.
Yeah, I think, too, though, a lot of the people who, pushed this along were also, lame ducks. It was after the election. They weren't going to, they were term limited, et cetera. They were able to put this in. The governor had just been reelected for another term, I think what's also important to, reflect on is, even with the prominence of Flint's story, and even as there has been a lot of reflection on the limits of and failures of the emergency manager law, suggestions for reform, if not outright appeal. The law, as it was then, stands now. It has not been changed. It is still on the books.
All right. So take us through. So with this law in place, the dilemma facing Flint was that they had been on a water system for 50 some odd years, that that water system had a monopoly, essentially, and was really overcharging, it seems like, Flint. And so Flint came up with another idea that we're going to get our own water from a different Great Lake or just a different pipeline from that Great Lake. But then they had to do something in the interim, right? Is that the story?
Yeah, that's the gist of it. It's like what was happening was that so Flint back in the 60s when it was growing, they felt like they needed to sign on with Detroit's water system to support what they thought was ongoing development and evolution for the city. They signed a long-term contract to get Detroit Lake Huron water from Detroit, one of the Great Lakes, and while there has been, cost was an issue, and I'll talk about that in just a minute, quality wasn't. They did get good quality water. The biggest problem that was facing Flint is that while they had lost half its population and, you know, the industry that was using up to 60% of Flint's water supply, the infrastructure did not shrink accordingly, right? So you have far fewer and far poorer ratepayers supporting this gigantic system, and they can't do it. You know, you just can't do it. They, even though they were paying among the most expensive water rates in the nation, they weren't able to. They were still losing like 50% of their water through just leaks, which of course is driving up the rates even more.
So they didn't have the ability to take care of an infrastructure that had massive pipes because they were used to bringing it into a ton of GM plants. And twice the population, it would be the functional equivalent of like, you know, living in a big McMansion. And then all of a sudden your 12 kids move out and it's just you alone there and you got to take care of the place.
Yeah. The math just does not work out. And there were things that they were especially, you know, frustrated with the Detroit system for, like the Detroit contract had, some like upcharges for like the distance it had to pipe water to Flint and elevation, things that were non-negotiable, it seemed. Flint didn't feel like they had a seat at the table, even though they were the system's second largest customer. So they were looking at other options for years, even before emergency management. They're looking for other options. And what they decided to do under emergency management, under its second emergency manager, it had four consecutive ones, beginning on in 2011, it was the first community in Michigan put under this expanded emergency manager law. So under emergency management, they decide they're going to join this brand new water system that's going to be built. It's also going to draw water from Lake Huron, except the communities are going to have to treat it itself, which is it's going to deliver raw water. Partly because they wanted to serve agricultural customers and stuff like that. So Flint, under emergency management, decides they want to join the system. It's not even built yet. It won't be built for a couple of years. So again, under emergency management, they decided that in the interim, they'll reboot their old city plant, which they're going to need to reboot anyway, and they're going to treat their own water from the Flint River. And the Flint River, while it had been very, very heavily polluted in the 20th century because of all these industries, because of, you know, environmental laws not really coming into play until the 1970s, the river is much healthier today than it once was. But it is, like any river, you know, more complex to treat than lake water. The upgrades this plant received were not sufficient to deal with those complexities. And one of the most significant omissions was that the water was not treated with something called corrosion control, which is a violation of federal law. This is what you're supposed to add to a water supply to make sure that these old aging pipes that are the water passes through in almost every community across the country does not corrode into the water and contaminate it by the time it reaches our taps. So, and this besides this city being under emergency management, the switch was also being supervised by the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. That when you know they finally flipped the switch in April of 2014, turned off the Detroit water, they're going to the Flint River. There, you could see in the videos of this that you know you're not just seeing the mayor and the emergency manager there. You're seeing, you know, the legislative officials and MDQ officials there, you know, celebrated and toasting it. And they're really championing this. Is like, look at Flint, like getting back to its roots and seeing this switch as a sign of sovereignty and so on. But it was. It was, of course, a celebration that they now regret.
Indeed. And it turned out to be quite tragic for a lot of people who ended up drinking that water. And so just to reiterate, river water is a much different job, treating river water, much different job than treating lake water. And the Great Lakes, obviously, probably the greatest source of fresh water, drinking mm-hmm. water in the country, in the hemisphere, I guess. So they restart this old plant. They don't have the physical apparatus and or, it seems to me, the institutional memory in the form of people who have treated water to understand the implications of what they're doing, because to treat this water with anti-corrosive material is not terribly expensive, is it?
It wasn't terribly expensive, and it wasn't even like it, in some ways, this just seems like completely baffling, you know, especially because the State Department of Environmental Quality is like supervising this, and they're saying, you know, a lot of this is, I should note, a lot of this is story is being contested in courtrooms right now. But there was the State Environmental Authority, you know, saying that, like, yeah, this is fine. This is fine as it is. They read the law in a different way, I guess, you know.
But aren't they scientists? Yeah, like, I mean, aren't they people who, like, okay, the law says we don't have to do this, but if we look at this and we can just sort of just assess, like, what we know about water, or were they just incompetent?
Yeah, that, I mean, it seems, I mean, you know, like it's completely mysterious because it seems very, very logical. Even I'm not a scientist, but it seems very logical that river water is more corrosive than lake water. If you put it through these aging pipes, including lead service lines, and you don't add any corrosion control, then the pipes are going to corrode faster than they normally would. And there were signs of this happening really soon after the switch. You know. When people had discolored water, that was corroded iron. The switch happened in April of 2014. By October, a big GM engine plant was noticing that it was corroding their parts so severely that they needed to leave the city system and hook onto a suburb's water, which was still getting water from Detroit. And yet there was no intervention to about like how this might be affecting residents.
All right. Well, I want to just put a pin in that no intervention, because that gets back to the complete lack of democracy story and accountability. But we should just say that when GM switched over, the problems they were having with building the engines ended that day. Like it was that immediate. All right. So, but let's just stop for a moment and tell us about the Legionnaire's disease.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. Like, one thing that's important to remember about Flint's story is that lead is definitely a piece of it, but there was a number of contamination issues. The first one that got on people's radar was E. coli bacteria that, you know, caused a number of boil water advisories. There was also a carcinogenic byproduct of the disinfection process, something called TTHMs, a chemical compound. That was a violation of the Safe Drinking Water Law. And then there was also this Legionnaire's disease outbreak. Legionnaire's disease is caused by a kind of waterborne bacteria called Legionella. It's not that you drink it, but you sort of inhale it, like through a water vapor, like in a shower or bath or something. When there have been outbreaks around the country, it often spreads through like air conditioning systems in like a large building. It causes like a severe form of pneumonia. It's in your lungs. It's a severe form of pneumonia, and it can be deadly. The Flint and, you know, its vicinity experienced an outbreak of Legionnaire's disease over 2015 and 2016. But it was not made publicly known until, over 2014 and 2015, but it was not made publicly known until January 2016, which is the same month that, you know, this was breaking in the national press in a very big way.
That's nuts, right? Like, that's the primary function of your Department of Health is to say, we've got a problem here. Everybody needs to stop. Like, just stop, you know, like, be suspect of those activities that could get you Legionnaire's disease.
Right. I mean, when there's been outbreaks, you know, when there was an outbreak of Legionnaire's disease in the Bronx, I believe, over the summer of 2015, it was that, you know, to their credit, like, public health officials, you know, made the news, put the news out there right away, even before they knew the exact source of the outbreak. You know, so people could take what protections they felt like they needed to take,
and
especially
doctors,
vulnerable populations.
And doctors mm-hmm. could know that, like, this is out there. So if you see symptoms that might be Legionnaire's disease, there's a higher...
You can test for it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Higher probability that it is. Right.
And so, within just a few weeks, they were able to trace it to the source. With the Flint story, there's still some... It's almost certainly connected to the water switch. There's scientific evidence to suggest that so, but there's also a limited number of it's difficult to prove because there wasn't the collection of biological samples at the time that one would need to do some direct comparisons. And there wasn't as much testing of people for Legionnaire's disease as you would expect if there was a lot of like widespread notice of this. And as you mentioned before, like, this literally cost people's lives. Like, 12 is the official record. There's a lot of people in Flint and some journalists too, including some folks from PBS Frontline who just did a really good examination of this about who believe that the uptick in pneumonia deaths over the same time were probably really Legionnaire's disease and connected to that outbreak as well. It was just misdiagnosed.
Wow. All right. And so and then let's talk about lead. I mean, this I'd like to think that longtime listeners of this program are well versed in how impactful exposure to lead can be. I mean, there's some who theorize that the massive drop in crime that we've seen nationally and internationally is a function of leaded gas being outlawed. And then 20 years later, we see these corresponding drops in crime because lead has such a strong impact on the development of the brain. And mm-hmm. particularly in kids when their brains are developing. So there's no way to measure this, right? I mean, it's just, you don't know how much lead has been ingested by kids from Flint. Like, this is something like we won't know the implications of this for 20 some odd years.
I do think that's true. I do think that this is one reason thing that people mean when they say the Flint water crisis isn't over is that, you know, you have to wait for folks to grow up, you know, and there's a number of recovery efforts that are happening and, you know, a number of reasons to like have every bit of like hope in the future for a lot of these like really beautiful and brilliant children that are growing up in this community. But yeah, like, I think this is like what you're saying about like how lead works, just how it works. It makes it very tricky to trace very direct causes and effects. And this is why, even though lead is one of our best known neurotoxins, like we've known of its toxic effect on humans for thousands of years, literally, we nonetheless like built everything out of lead, you know, our paint, our fuel, and our drinking water infrastructure. And that's partly like we partly got away with that. So to speak, because you know, people, you had all this like plausible deniability about how lead was actually affecting people. So children are absolutely more vulnerable. That they can absorb up to 5 times as much lead as an adult from the same amount of exposure. You can test it for a limited time in their when it's still in their blood, but then it's eventually absorbed into their bones and tissues, kind of like calcium is, and it stays there. This is why it can have, you know, effect that goes on, you know, later in life, you know. It can cause developmental delays. It can cause kidney damage. It can cause, you know, antisocial behavior, impulse, you know, issues, a number of problems. It also is unhealthy for adults, and especially pregnant adults, infants, you know, who drink formula with water that might be have a high lead content are very vulnerable. It can cause fertility issues for people. There have been researchers looking, you know, at Flint to see if there has been, you know, a rise in miscarriages and stillbirths, or you know, just other issues that might be related to the water. It's just bad for us. And while we did finally get to the point where we put laws out like banning, you know, lead pipes put into new infrastructure systems and house paint, and we no longer have leaded fuel, that's all great. But we haven't done a full reckoning with the legacy of the lead that's still in our environment, that people are still coming in contact with every day. And this is part of why it's not just Flint's story, right? And, you know, we have lead everywhere.
And we should say they're all basically ticking time bombs, right? I mean, because the lead's there, that you can treat your water only so much in terms of being anti-corrosive. At one point, it starts to break down, and it just means that it breaks down later. Right. I mean, so.
Yeah. Yeah. There is that. That's one of the critiques that a lot of people have over our environmental laws. Right. Our lead and copper rule nationally through the EPA, the minimum standards that's set are quite loose. And so is the sampling rules. And it allows up to 15 parts per billion of lead in 90% of homes in a community before it triggers a response. So 10% of homes in a community can have all kinds of lead in their drinking water. It doesn't raise any flags at all. This community
sounds
can
like 85%. 85%. It sounds like, right, can have a tremendous amount of lead until you hit like 91%. It doesn't kick in, or no? Do I misunderstand?
Nothing. If a community can show that it's like up to 90% of homes have. Of less than 15 parts
I see.
Per billion.
Okay.
Even so, then they
so
quote
got it
unquote
backwards.
Say it's safe.
So
now we know no amount of lead is safe. We know that, but the law is written in a way because it acknowledges that there will be lead in our water, if so long as we have lead in our pipes and our plumbing infrastructure, you know, both in home and outside the home. And I think I would love to see Flint's story to help galvanize the political will for people to deal with that, you know, like we do got to get rid of it. Great. We're not putting new pipes, lead pipes in the ground, but how about getting rid of the ones that are already there?
All right. So,
and they're getting older.
So we have 15 people who have been indicted who have been criminally charged, around this, ranging from, involuntary manslaughter to, obstruction of justice, you know, different folks hiding, the truth of this. How is it that Rick Snyder got away without any, it seems to me, legal consequences?
It's a lot of people have asked that. I have a few thoughts on that. I think, well, one thing that I think is true is that I do think that there are people who have responsibility for this, that just because their names aren't prominent as public figures does not mean that they were you know, that they didn't have like a direct hands in the choices that led to this situation, right? So sometimes I've seen people react to the names of those who are indicted, and if they don't recognize them, they just assume they're scapegoats, you know?
Right.
Which I don't think is quite accurate. Also, I think that we have some real limitations in our legal system and in our laws when it comes to environmental crimes, you know? Even the most famous you know, and so-called environmental triumphs, you know, in the legal system, like the Aaron Brockovich case, for example, where there was citywide water contamination in Southern California. You know, like they always end in sort of settlements with no admission of wrongdoing. You know, it's really hard to trace responsibility with these kinds of cases because of how they play out, you know? Like, so even in a community that's had, for example, let's say, like, there's, like, a cancer-causing element in a community's groundwater, and you can see that, you know, the community's experiencing cancer at twice the level than you would expect it to be. For any one particular person's cancer, it's really hard to point it to the person right. who contaminated it, because maybe they would have had cancer anyway. You know, it's sort of how this works. And also, I think, you know, we're also, like, you know, dealing with one of the consequences of bureaucracy, which is that if everybody's responsible, nobody's responsible. You know, that, like, there's everybody can sort of, you know, point to other people saying, like, well, they were responsible for this decision, and then the other person was like, no, they were, and you know, and the governor's been able to hold himself at some remove from a lot of this. According to him, he didn't know the full scope of the Flint water crisis until late September 2015, just shortly before the state finally conceded and helped hook Flint back onto Detroit water, which didn't solve all its problems, but was a big move.
Okay.
Even if you take him at his word, that's still wild.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I don't, frankly, I find that very hard to believe that there was no word back up. And your book sort of tells the story of basically how, different folks in the community ended up, forcing the hand, and the national reporting also started to create some pressure. So what is the status now, though? I mean, where is Flint now in terms of, like, does everybody have clean drinking water? Supposedly?
Yeah. Well, what's happening right now is that, because of a class action settlement, the state is paying to replace all of Flint's drinking water infrastructure because of the damage that corrosion did. That is a process that's still in place right now and will continue until about 2019, 2020. That is one reason that a lot of folks feel like they don't yet trust the water coming out of their taps. It is Detroit water. It is appropriately treated. But when you do a big shakeup with the infrastructure like that, that is known, that's proven to sometimes cause upticks in lead and other contaminants, you know, elsewhere in the system. The state has, however, as of April, discontinued the bottled water service it had been providing to residents, you know, so where people could go to pick up sites and gather some cases of free bottled water for them and their families. That discontinued in April. The state said it was because they had seen, you know, a couple rounds of lead tests that showed that the lead amounts were quote unquote normal. In other words, it's not that there was no lead, but it was comparable with other communities. So people had feelings about that.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah. So those are the bigger things that are happening. And then people are watching these criminal cases play out. It's probably going to take years before this all unfolds. But when we're talking, today, like in just a few days, we should get a ruling on whether the highest level official, the director of Health and Human Services, somebody who the governor has 100% supported and is still in his job and actively working in this job, if he will or will not be going on from his preliminary examination onto trial. We should be finding that out, I think, on the 25th, August 25th.
Well, the book is The Poison City, Flint's Water, and the American Urban Tragedy. Anna Clark, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. We'll put a link at majority.fm to your book.
This was such a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for it.
Thank you, Anna. Bye-bye. All right, folks, we will head into the fun half. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, we say thank you by giving you extra content every day. It is just it's under 50 cents a day now. We've calculated to support this program. And keep us chugging along. Of course, You get access to all the searchable archives of our fun half. So you could go back, I don't know, years ago now. What are we on? What episode is this? 1907. Nuts. That's a lot of episodes. We are, if my calculations are correct, 93 episodes away from 2,000 episodes. So, also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off all of your coffee needs. Buy the Majority Report blend. Do yourself a favor. Today is Monday. Tomorrow is Tuesday. Tuesday nights is the Michael Brooks Show. What's happening on the Michael Brooks Show, Michael Brooks?
Well, there is a secret celebrity guest coming in, and people are speculating. And
secret celebrity guest.
Secret celebrity guest. People are speculating. There's a lot of speculation.
Is it your anniversary, right? Is that it?
Year-long anniversary of the launch of the show. And
I hope it's John Benjamin.
Me too. I think we all do.
John Benjamin?
I think we all hope it's completely out of left field.
No, I know. He's just a celebrity.
No, Benjamin really a celebrity?
We've DM'd together about doing stuff, actually.
Oh, well, okay.
I'll be disappointed if it's anyone but him.
I can understand that. And I hate to disappoint you.
John Benjamin. We've never, ever even heard now, you ever now say the
now
word
Matt's
John
imposing
Benjamin.
Imposing emotional labor on me. So that's happening. There's, of course, going to be a David Griscom Economic Minute. Jake Tapper will probably go in the gulag. That won't even be a surprise. I want to say just really quick for last week's show, do you remember a Piggate, David Cameron's Piggate story? Do you remember that from a couple years ago?
Piggate.
The former prime minister of the UK, the doo-doo-doo guy.
Yeah, I saw that episode of Black Mirror.
But no, that actually happened.
Well,
I know.
Possibly
did you know that
happened.
That?
I did,
it possibly
yeah.
happened.
Possibly.
I'm not familiar with Piggate.
It was
as a schoolboy, David Cameron may have stuck his something in a pig's mouth as a part of like a Tory,
as a part of some type
bonding,
of, right? Like old school arrested
society.
Oh,
yes.
All right. Well,
now
I guess,
we
I guess
got
that's
into
now a gate. All
we
right.
got it literally
as
was
opposed
called
to just
gate.
A young
pig mouth,
young you know
what rich
middle what? School?
No, college
prank, college.
Call it,
college
well,
prank.
Oh, now you are in the Tory state of mind. Right?
Public school buggery.
Yeah, public exactly. school buggery.
We did cow tipping in North Dakota, but
there really anybody? Come on.
And so I just because I know I wanted to just say that a lot. This so many people have said that Brendan's bedding the Downton Abbey music underneath us talking about that was really funny. So I wanted to give him a special shout out for that. But yeah, that's what's happening on Tuesday. And then we're working on an illicit slash sort of up to date one on what's happening with Turkey's economy, because it might melt the global economy.
Yes.
And that's for
real...
patrons. That's what we're working on as well. So patreon.com/TMBS. Celebrity guests. Sorry, Matt.
And Jamie, what is happening on the Antifada?
Well, if you liked our last episode featuring Comrade Communicator, we now have a bonus Real Posadist Hours, where we go over yet more wacky writings of Jay Posadas. We also recorded an episode over the weekend with Army resistor Spencer Rapone. You may know him as the guy who wrote Communism Will Win on his cap at his West Point graduation and became a meme instantly. We talked to the man behind the meme about the connection between capitalism and imperialism. We do a little comparative history of the Vietnam War and the mutinies during it and the Carnation Revolution in Portugal. And we talk about the army as a potential site of class struggle.
And Matt, back from vacation.
Did post an episode over the weekend, intro to the Scarlet Letter, called The Custom House by Nathaniel Hawthorne. A couple things in there are how Nathaniel Hawthorne made a lot of money working for the government. You could just skim off the top if you worked for the Customs House back then. And yet he did write in that introduction that you can't be a worthwhile member of society if you're living off the government dole. Also,
listening to these pods on Hawthorne, it's amazing who you can feel such contempt for. You're like just some like random like high school author, and all of a sudden you're like, I hate that guy.
Also, I don't hate him, but he is problematic. Also, his dad brought the first elephant to the United States from Southeast Asia, and when they got it on board, they realized it was drinking all the water, so they switched it to booze, and then they had to advertise it as an alcoholic elephant when they were back in the States.
Oh, that is a great story. What a wonderful family.
They're such assholes.
What a wonderful
horrible family.
Wonderful people. All right. Well, we're going to take a break and just laugh and laugh about forcing a kidnapping an elephant and then turning it into a problem drinker. All right, 646-257-3920 is the number. Join us in the fun half.